I was talking about a really promising over-the-counter supplement called PEA, palmitil ethanolamide, which is a very potent anti-inflammatory for the brain and the body, very helpful for pain, for allergies as well. And we answered some really interesting questions today. We talked about dealing with depression in the context of a relationship and why it's important not to give up on a relationship, how you can communicate with your partner to serve your needs while you're depressed, but also take your responsibility in getting your mental health treatment taken care of. We talked about dating actually a lot today. We talked about how do you kind of date in the post-COVID era when people are kind of a little bit awkward and still getting into the things of things, why it's actually even more important to avoid online dating, how to do more in-person dating and find the right venues, right approaches that are gonna maximize your success. Hey everyone, welcome to Maximus Colin Radio show number 29. Amazing how time flies, and welcome to the first week of summer, I believe. It is feeling nice and warm here in LA. You can see my background over there on Santa Monica Beach, and the world is opening up. LA actually opened up on June 15th. And so a lot of good omens and new beginnings for the world. So I'm excited, I'm optimistic, and I'm excited to spend this hour with you, helping optimize your health, hormones, and life in general. So we always start the show with a weekly unpopular opinion. I love to share my unpopular opinions on Twitter, and I like to do a little bit more of a deep dive live as we're doing these radio shows. So this week's unpopular opinion is actually a pharmacology-related one. So my unpopular opinion is that the best cannabinoid is actually not THC or CBD. It's actually something that almost nobody has heard of. It's something called palmitil ethanolamide, or PEA for short. Now, this is not to be confused with another PEA, which is beta-phenylethylamine. That's a central nervous stimulant, so that's a totally different drug, and we're not talking about that today. We're talking about palmitil ethanolamide, or PEA, and it's a very, very interesting compound. It's actually sold over-the-counter now as a supplement. And let me tell you a little bit about why it's so interesting. So we have something called the endocannabinoid system. So you basically have, I kind of make the analogy of like a lock and key in your brain. So you have cannabinoid receptors. The two main ones are CB1 and CB2 in your brain. And then when you put a key in the lock of those receptors, it activates and stimulates them and has sort of effects on the brain. So most people are, of course, familiar with THC. THC is the most active cannabinoid that's in marijuana, and that binds to the cannabinoid receptors and obviously gets you high, has psychoactive effects, in addition to effects on, you know, the other sort of medicinal effects that it has. CBD, which is sort of the non-psychoactive cannabinoid, one of dozens of cannabinoids, does not psychoactive, obviously does not get you high, but it has potential benefits in terms of pain, inflammation, sleep. I actually think, this is my unpopular opinion, that CBD is very, very overhyped, and I'll tell you why. So first of all, the main issue that you see, you know, it's a legal product, it's over the counter, they put in all kinds of drinks. You can walk into any liquor store almost in the country now, and there's some hemp-infused beverage, functional beverages that they're called. If you look at actually the label, most of them put somewhere between 5 and 25 milligrams. And it really has no noticeable effects. The one FDA-approved version of CBD that is prescription actually has the dosage at 100 milligrams. So you really need to be taking triple-digit milligrams in order to have a therapeutic effect of CBD, and almost all the products over-the-counter are essentially underdosed. So that's problem number one. Problem number two is actually it's really expensive, right? So if you want to buy like a therapeutically effective CBD product, you probably need, 100 milligrams at a time. And if you buy like 1,000 grams, it's usually like $100. So you're talking about spending $100 for 10 doses or $10 per dose. That's actually crazy expensive. You think about compared to like an over-the-counter or prescription painkiller, you know, you can get generic medications now for $4 for 30-day supply, or even $10 for a 90-day supply. So literally you're talking about 90 times more expensive than the prescription drugs. And while I'm all for sort of all natural things, it doesn't really, kind of the cost benefit analysis doesn't really make sense. So as an alternative, to CBD. And obviously you don't want to be taking THC all the time because you're going to be high. And quite frankly, it's not very functional if you want to be a motivated, productive individual. There's something that's an alternative called palmitol ethanolamide. Now, PEA is actually a natural compound. It's found in egg yolks, peanuts, soybeans, and actually a whole bunch of different foods in various degrees. It's actually also endogenously produced by your body. Every single one of you right now has PEA circulating throughout your system. So it's called essentially an endogenous, meaning it's naturally produced by the body, ligand. And the reason it's so interesting is it actually, unlike THC and CBD, does not have direct and agonist effects on those CB1 and CB2 receptors. So it actually works in a little bit of a different way, and I'll explain the pharmacology just in case you science nerds are sort of interested. So it actually has two direct effects that we know of. So one is it's a direct molecular target of something called PPAR alpha, which is a target of something called fibrates. Fibrates are prescription drugs that are used to lower cholesterol, essentially. PPAR alpha is really important because it essentially mediates inflammation, and that's where it exerts essentially very potent anti-inflammatory effects. The other receptor system that it binds to is something called GPR55. GPR55 is related to the cannabinoid receptors CB1 and CB2. And so even though it doesn't directly bind to CB1 and CB2, it kind of indirectly has an effect through something that's called the entourage effect. And so indirectly, it has an effect, and GPR55 also has anti-inflammatory effects. So the other really interesting thing is, so even though it's an indirect target of CB1 and CB2, it has a property, it's known as a FAH inhibitor. So it's a fatty acid amine hydroxylate inhibitor. And FAH is basically an enzyme that breaks down your natural cannabinoids, right, that your body produces. So if you inhibit the enzyme that breaks down your cannabinoids, it essentially allows more and more buildup of cannabinoids in your system. An example of this is a cannabinoid called anandamide. Anandamide is essentially commonly known as the bliss molecule, right? It induces feelings of sort of bliss and euphoria. So if you inhibit the enzyme that breaks down your cannabinoids, and you get more and more of those that kind of build up, and you get a little bit more of the positive sort of mood effects from it. Finally, it has an effect on a system called TRPV1. TRPV1 is known as the capsaicin receptor, and you may have heard of capsaicin because it's the chemical that's in hot chili peppers that literally is responsible for it being hot and has the sort of burning effect. But if you also might have heard that capsaicin is commonly used in over-the-counter topical creams that are kind of like Bengay because it has analgesic effects, or in terms of relieving pain. So that's kind of the pharmacology of how it works. The reason I can kind of explain all these kind of receptor systems that you may not be familiar with is that they're unique receptor systems, right? If you think about how most painkillers work, they're either usually prescription painkillers work on the opioid system, right? And that's the same system that heroin and morphine and codeine all work on. The problem, of course, with that is it shuts down your respiration, which is how people die when they overdose. And it's highly addictive, right? You don't want to be taking prescription painkillers unless you absolutely have to, because of the addiction qualities to it. The other sort of over-the-counter class of pain-relieving medications are called NSAIDs, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Those are the Advils, ibuprofens, naproxens, aspirins of the world. The problem with those is that they're not really great on your liver. So you can obviously take them acutely or in small dosages or for short amounts of time. But, you know, if you read actually the instructions, they say, you know, do not take more than 4 or 6 in a 24-hour period. Don't drink while you're consuming these, because they are very harsh in the liver. And so you don't want to necessarily be chronically taking those over time. They also seem to mess with the stomach and can have a negative sort of effects on the GI system. So that's why PEA is so interesting, is because it actually has analgesic or pain relieving effects through a totally different mechanism that is, in my opinion, a lot safer. So what are the uses of PEA? So the number one thing that it seems to be used for in clinical studies is actually pain relief. So if you have chronic pain, sort of a nagging injury. Obviously, I'm not providing medical advice. Talk to your doctor. But I think it's a very novel and interesting alternative to popping pain, prescription painkillers, or even over-the-counter painkillers, because it is a molecule that's essentially endogenously produced by the body. You're taking something that's bioidentical, doesn't seem to have any addiction qualities, doesn't seem to have any dependence qualities in that respect, and it doesn't seem, at least as far as I know, to shut down your endogenous production of it, kind of like what you see with hormones. So very kind of promising sort of pain relief treatment, especially for sort of neuropathic pain. So that's number one. It's a great pain reliever. Number two, it's a very potent anti-inflammatory. So there's all these sort of neurodegenerative diseases that you may have heard of, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, MS, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. And there's a lot of promising research that's showing that if you can lower neuroinflammation or inflammation in the brain, which PEA seems to be able to do, it may help mitigate some of the damage that's happening with these sort of neurodegenerative diseases. So that's one. And then second is, if you think about conditions where there's a lot of brain inflammation or neuroinflammation, you think about stroke and you think about traumatic brain injury or concussions. So if you suffered from TBI or concussions, it may also be very helpful in reducing the inflammation that comes from the trauma that's elicited to the head. As I mentioned, it's also very helpful for pain. And then it also seems to be very helpful for sort of general or systemic inflammation because of its ability to modulate mast cell activation. You might have heard of mast cell activation as something that's involved in the allergic process. So if you commonly have allergies, PEA actually is a very promising anti-allergy treatment that doesn't cause sort of the drowsiness that you see commonly with antihistamines. So if antihistamines, you know, you want to avoid the side effects of those, or you find that the non-drowsy anti-allergy medications like the Claritins of the world aren't doing it for you, you may want to try PEA in consultation with your doctor. And then obviously inflammation seems to be in a implicated more and more in all kinds of issues, including psychiatric conditions such as depression and metabolic conditions such as diabetes and cardiometabolic syndrome. And so if you have a lot of inflammation that's going on in your body, PEA may also be very sort of promising. So it has actually a lot of different effects. And like I said, in the relative spectrum of safety, it's relatively safe and it's something that's sort of naturally produced in the body. You can actually buy it as an over-the-counter supplement. If you do, I highly recommend that you buy a form that is ultra micronized. What basically means is that they made it into a very small particle size, and it really helps the absorption of it. So there's micronized and it's ultra micronized. So it's super, super small molecules. And that really seems to improve the absorption and bioavailability of it. So make sure that you're buying a form that's ultra micronized. Secondarily, even though it's a very potent anti-inflammatory, it doesn't have antioxidant properties. And so you're seeing a lot of the research literature actually combine it with a compound called luteolin, which is an antioxidant. And so these two compounds together, PEA and luteolin, seem to have sort of a synergistic effect. So you can kind of take both of these together and they seem to very complement one another. So like I said, not providing sort of medical advice, but if you're really sort of interested in supplements, you're interested in brain health, you're interested in anything that sort of reduces pain, inflammation, allergies, it's a very kind of promising compound, and I think we're going to see a lot more research literature on it. I think some of it we don't really know yet. Like, I think there may be some very promising potential in terms of using this for instance, sleep, because you know a lot of people you know are looking for sort of effective over-the-counter sleep supplements that are non-habit-forming, non-addictive, and same thing with sort of the mood effects. It's sort of unclear. I don't think there's enough research literature on the effects on depression and anxiety, which may be mediated by inflammation. But if you have sort of a depressive subtype that is particularly inflammatory, it could be very helpful. I think the research literature is yet to be determined. The jury is still out, so to speak. But if you're willing to sort of experiment under the consultation of your doctor, I actually think it's very promising stuff. So that's my weekly unpopular opinion. Don't smoke weed every day. And CBD is overrated, but I think PEA is actually quite promising and nobody knows about it. So you heard it here first, folks.
We have a question via YouTube. I have depression and I'm in a relationship, but sometimes I am afraid to do something if he left me. Is it okay to have a partner?
First of all, I'm very sorry to hear that you're suffering from depression. Unfortunately, it's very common these days. I believe like the average prevalence rate of depression at any given time is about 20%, I believe. So you're not alone. One in five people essentially have a clinically severe form of depression. Now, it sounds like you're struggling with depression in the context of a relationship. And it sounds like you're afraid that he may leave you, if I understand correctly. So I guess, Victor, the question was, is it okay to be in a relationship while suffering from depression? So, yeah, I mean, look, if you're already in a relationship, it doesn't preclude you. Like I said, the reason I sort of mentioned the base rate is if you assume one in five people have depression at any given time, or let's say in the course of an average year, there's tons of people who have depression, not to mention many other psychiatric conditions and are in the context of relationships. So it does not preclude you from being in a relationship. Now, will it potentially interfere with your functioning or the quality of your relationship? Absolutely. In fact, one of the criteria for what makes something clinical depression or what's called major depressive disorder, MDD, is by definition, it has to interfere with either your social or your occupational function. Meaning that if it is getting in the way of your relationships and it's significantly harming the quality of your relationships, that's what makes it a clinically significant disorder. So I guess my question back to you, and you can type this into the YouTube notes, is I'd love for you to tell me how it's impacting your relationship. Like, what's your perception of how it affects your interaction with you and sounds like your boyfriend, if I'm presuming correctly. So while you type that out, I'll kind of give you my kind of general thoughts and then we can talk a little bit about specifics. So like I said, you don't need to like exit a relationship just because you're struggling with something. Now, I think there's two important things. Is one, I do think it's obviously important to have a supportive partner and be able to, first of all, talk about that, right? If you're struggling with depression, hopefully you have a trusting sort of relationship where you can be open and honest about that. If you feel like you can't talk about that with your partner, then I would say there's something wrong with your relationship and you need to obviously work that out. Because I think a lot of the, quite frankly, the value of a relationship is to have someone who's there with you literally in sickness and in health, right? Those are the common things in your marriage vows. Now, even if you're not married, you want to be able to be working towards that and finding a long-term partner who can support you in sickness and in health. And so I do think hopefully you have that foundation where it's like you can talk about it, right? So hopefully you've established that. Second, I think it is important to talk to your partner about it and explain, like, you know, when your mood's not good, when you're kind of feeling high, when you're feeling low. And so they can and try to explain to them how they can support you. Right? Sometimes a lot of people, they're like, I don't necessarily need any advice. I don't need them to try to cheer me up. I don't need them to give me like a pep talk. It's none of that. Maybe I just want him to hold me. You know what I mean? And that's what I need in that moment. Or maybe, you know, I just need a good cry and I need him to, like, I don't know, help make dinner once in a while when I'm not really feeling up to it. Right? And so those are really examples of how you can proactively communicate your needs to your partner and they can be supportive.
Follow-up comment, sometimes my head is a mess and I feel very insecure. Something I feel like he might be cheating on me, but I feel like I'm very toxic about it.
So it sounds like there is some insecurity and you have the psychological insight to recognize that, right? That seems to be kind of the theme in your comments, right? It sounds like, should I even be in a relationship? Am I sort of unworthy of being in it because I'm depressed? Is he going to leave me? It sounds like to me, and you know, obviously this is very limited context in which I know you, you're speaking in a way that is very emblematic of like a low self-esteem, right? And so that may be sort of driving your depression as one of the causal factors or root issues, right? If you have a low self-esteem, you take things a lot more personally, right? And you sort of blame it on yourself when things go wrong. And that kind of personalizing thought pattern can contribute to depression. And obviously when you're depressed, it's easier to sort of blame yourself or beat yourself up. So I would actually highly encourage you, if you haven't already, to actually seek out therapy. It sounds like it'd be very helpful for you to start to recognize sort of these belief systems or thought patterns that you're having that may be contributing to, or at least exacerbating, your depression, right? So I don't like the word toxic, by the way. I think it's one of the most overused terms, and you've heard me talk about toxic masculinity and why that's so problematic. Because I think it's important to, and this is very relevant to you, is separate the person from the behavior, right? That's why I don't like to say, oh, they're a depressive or they're a schizophrenic, because that becomes their identity. That's them. Versus they're a person with schizophrenia, the person with depression, especially depression, because depression, even with people who have severe recurrent depression, they're not usually depressed all the time. It comes and it goes, right? So that means there are a person who, even without the depression, and obviously they're the same person with depression, they're obviously just not feeling and functioning as well, right? And so I think you have to disidentify the person from the behavior or the milieu of the condition in terms of having the depression, right? You are not a depressive. You're just a person who unfortunately is struggling with depression right now. And there's nothing inherently toxic about that. You're just kind of going through a hard time. Now, I think it is important though, in terms of what are the patterns of behavior that you're engaging with when you're depressed with your boyfriend. Like, I'm curious, when you're feeling depressed, how is it affecting your sort of interactions? Did she say something else besides the toxic in that last comment?
It's very consuming. My thoughts are like, I'm in a pool. I feel trapped in a pool, and it's starting to take me deeper and deeper.
Yeah. I mean, the way that you describe it, I mean, it's very vivid, right? And a little dark. You know, and that's very emblematic of sort of the thought pattern and the feelings that go along with depression, right? It does feel very all-consuming. A lot of people sort of, you know, describe it as like a blanket that they can't get off of them, or a black dog. And, you know, your kind of description sort of reminds me of that. So, I mean, look, I feel your pain. Even the way that you describe it is sort of very vivid. And that's why I think it's important to try to get as much support as you can. By the way, if your relationship, other than kind of the struggles that you're having with depression, is otherwise good, I would actually encourage you not to sort of, like, in the middle of your depression, try to leave your relationship because you don't think it's necessarily fair to the other person, especially if you're coming from this sort of low self-esteem kind of place where, right, where you may be a lot harsher on yourself than he is, right? If he makes that choice, that's a different matter. But I don't think you need to preemptively sort of exit yourself from that. And in fact, I would argue that if you do have a good relationship, it's actually very protective of you in helping you and providing you with support while you're depressed, because at least you got someone, right? And even if, you know, the relationship's not ideal because you're obviously not feeling your best, it's really helpful to have someone who's loving and supporting through this time. So I think you need to bolster your self-worth a little bit and say, hey, you know what? I am struggling. I'm not feeling good. It does feel very enveloping. And, you know, this is something that I'm going to get through. I am deserving of a better life, and I'm deserving of love, as every human being is, right? So you don't need to prematurely exit from this relationship. Try to work through, like I said, with your partner and communicate your needs and how he can support you in the best way that he can while you're depressed. And at the same time, so you're asking him to be a supportive partner, you need to take on the responsibility of taking care of yourself as well, right? So I always think it's important to practice what you preach. If you're gonna ask him to help take care of you, then you gotta primarily take care of yourself. Go and seek treatment. I think it's a very good idea to obviously be in therapy. And if it's more severe than that, then, you know, your therapist can provide a reference to a psychiatrist as well, which can be very helpful if you have sort of a more severe form of depression. But I think it can be very helpful, and it's complementary, right? Your boyfriend obviously can't be your therapist, can't treat your depression, but he can provide you with the support to help get through it and provide sort of guidance. And it's ultimately your primary responsibility to seek help and get treatment. I know it feels very all-encompassing. I know it's very hard to go and take proactive measures when you're feeling down, but it's absolutely something that you can work through. So I'm happy to help provide some resources at the end of the show. The one that I'll provide, if you're not on Discord, is, well, first of all, if you do have health insurance, just try to go through your health insurance and find a therapist that's in network. If you can't do that, there is a SAMHSA. It's SAMHSA.gov. It's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's the part of the federal government that runs all the mental health services. You can go to that website, click Find Treatment, and there's a lot of resources that you can find to get mental health treatment. They also run the National Suicide Hotline, the 1-800-273-TALK number that you may have heard if you listen to Logic and some other musicians. And hopefully, you know, you can find some help out there. So best wishes with that. I know it's not easy to get through, but, you know, count your blessings that you're in a relationship and don't give up on it just because you're depressed.
Dating advice in post-COVID era, Dr. Camp.
Yeah, let's talk about it. Give me a little bit of context, though. That's a broad question.
Why are they so crazy, man? Like, to be honest.
What kind of craziness are you seeing out there?
I just feel like there's a lot of like resistance. I don't know. Like I obviously understand like chivalry. The guy has to like, you know, do the little chasing. I'm cool with all that, but there needs to be stuff like, I don't know, something like worthwhile of my time as the, you know, man in it too, you know? So like, I'm just curious, like what has worked from, you know, people that have shared and, you know, what are things that I guess we as men can do better as we are, you know, trying to find our significant other, for lack of a better word.
Sure. So just to clarify the context a little bit, it sounds like, you know, obviously post-COVID, you know, things are opening back up. People are more open to going out, or at least in theory. Are you finding that that's not the case and people are not willing to sort of go out and they're still
like, personally, I don't do dating apps. I like a bunch of my friends, I mean, you know my story pretty well because we connected last year, but like in terms of like dating apps, I went on Hinge for like a month, like not like super active, but like, you know, here and there. It's just like I feel like the quality is really and then personally I'm an in-person type of human being, so like online stuff, like I'm trying to like minimize the phone and the screen time as much as possible. So like, you know, now that things are opening up, I mean, you know, like earlier today I met a pretty nice girl at like the coffee shop, but like I'm just curious, like what things are working for other fellow brothers, what things can we do better? I'm just trying to like kind of gain more knowledge and insight, if anything. I can't say I've had issues. I'm just trying to gain more insight because I am looking to potentially find the one if it's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll give my take, and I actually want to hear from other people since you mentioned it out there. So here's one sort of observation that I've made is obviously COVID shifted. There was already a trend going on in terms of online dating is now by far the primary way people meet their partner. It's like eclipsed friendships, church, work, bars and clubs, basically everything. And it's kind of trumped all of it now, but I don't think it's for the best. I actually think like it's created a very strange dynamic of very weak, often relationships because of the excessive optionality of online dating. And also I think a lot of people end up together who are quite frankly not really meant to be. And there's some interesting demographic reasons for why that is, because, you know, in real life, you kind of just feel the vibe of someone and you don't go for an ideal thing. You're not like a 5'3" female who says the guy needs to be 6'3", right? In real life, the guy's going to go up to you. You like him or you don't. You don't sit there and like do this crazy algorithmic filtering that happens in online that becomes completely distorted, right? So that trend was already happening. And then what happened during COVID is the opportunity to meet people in person obviously completely was decimated, right? There's no place to go out to. People are literally wearing masks. You can't even see their face. And everyone's paranoid about getting COVID. So the whole vibe is completely wrong. So there was even more online dating that has happened. And I think literally, you know, people have lost their social skills. The guy who head of UCSF medicine was talking about how his son is autistic and went out recently and he came back smiling. His dad was like, "Why are you smiling, son?" And he was like, "Nobody else has social skills either." And I was like, wow, it was kind of a funny anecdote, but I was like, you know, there's a half truth in all humor, as I like to say. And so I think what you're probably picking up on as well is, I even though the world is going back to normal, I think there's been a period of time where, quite frankly, people have gotten lazy. They've become overly dependent on online dating, and some of them aren't going back. And it's probably because they're a little anxious, they're a little awkward, they're a little out of practice in terms of talking to people. So all these combinations, I think, has just created weirdness on the part of both men and women. So I think if you thought online dating was bad before, it's even worse now because there's even more people on it than there were before. And so especially from a guy's perspective, it's even more competitive. The odds are worse. And so I always tell people, look, if you're honestly, and if you don't know the answer to this, ask your friends. If you're not in the top 10 to 20% of men, right, in terms of especially physical attractiveness and in terms of your pictures looking good, and if you don't know this, there's like, I'm sure there's some hot or not, whatever, OkCupid evaluators that will tell you that. If you're not like an 8, 9, or 10 on these websites, it's basically worthless to do online dating. You're going to be swiping through hundreds, if not thousands, of profiles to find, quite frankly, someone who's probably more mediocre than if you just went up and did what you did, which is go up and talk to someone in a coffee shop. Ironically, I think in-person has gotten even better because everyone is so awkward and out of social skills, and people are not approaching people as much as they did before. Now I think it's relatively safe to do so because things are opening up, people are wearing masks a lot less. So I think, in fact, there's a great asymmetric opportunity and advantage that you have, that if you have the balls, literally, and courage to go up and talk to people in person, you're gonna blow people out of the water. So I think online has gotten worse, in person has gotten better. So take advantage essentially of that opportunity and try to meet people as much as you can in person. I am a fan of meeting people naturalistically, especially during the day, coffee shops, libraries, bookstores, shopping malls, out and about. Just even when you're doing your errands, if you see someone who catches your eye, just go up and say hi. It doesn't need to be a crazy line. You can say, hey, you know, you caught my interest, or, you know, by the way, here's a tip that I actually thought was very clever. If you don't know what to say when you're approaching someone, compliment them on something that's not genetic, right? So don't just go up to them and say, hey, you're really, really beautiful, right? They didn't do anything to earn that beauty. They just happened to be born to good parents. But compliment them on a behavior that they chose, right? You can compliment them on an outfit that they picked out. You can compliment them on their shoes, because that's something they did. They actively chose, right? So you're complimenting their taste. Then later on, you can compliment them on how cute they are and all this stuff. But I think there's something more virtuous, I think, about complimenting someone's style, taste, or effort that they've made. Hey, you know, like, I really like, you know, the color of your nails that you did, or whatever it is. And it's just a nice little opener.
That always works, to be honest. They like I mean, frankly, I say that. It works.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also rewarding good behavior. It's like, well, you're not rewarding someone for winning the genetic lottery and having a symmetrical face, but you are rewarding for someone for making an effort, and you appreciate that because you're noticing it and you're paying that compliment forward. So, I mean, that's my tip and advice. Do other folks have opinions, though? I'd love to hear from other folks. Like, or if anyone's out there dating, what do you find to be effective, or what are people finding now that the world is opening up again?
I mean, I just want to echo some of the things you said. I agree. Like, you know, not saying something, you know, like not complimenting their, like, you know, beauty, but actually complimenting their behavior or some tendency that you're like, oh, wow, this caught my eye. Or like, wow, you're actually standing out compared to all the other profiles or all the other women that I've seen. And I will say I'm very particular. And I mean, to each their own, like, but you know, I think one of the things I've noticed is that when you do approach them, as you said, since we've all been locked up, we've been inside for so long, I think the online dating is actually not really true representation of what they actually look like anymore, because the picture from a year ago is not really what they are now. I mean, I hate to say it, I'm not interested in fat women.
That's true.
Something personal, not interested. I'm not saying you're ugly, I'm just saying I'm not the right one for you. So like that said, I think going back to what you said about kind of emphasizing their behavioral tendencies, I think that's definitely key. And I like going to like coffee shops or like places like that over like a bar or like a club, because frankly I haven't really been to those places post-COVID. And like now I'm more kind of focused on like finding someone kind of within the, you know, the age range thing that we've spoken about, you know, take your age divided by two, added 7, and then kind of go through that range. And there's plenty of good fish out there. I'm just trying to like weed out what I like and what I don't like, and it's progressing really well. So again, I'm curious to hear what other brothers have to say. If not, then hopefully you guys are all in happy relationships. Yeah. And if so, then great. No need to talk about this further. I just wanted to kind of raise it because I think it's you know, summertime, we're all kind of out and about. I think it would be a good discussion topic, but thank you again.
Sure thing. By the way, if you are in a relationship, I think you're in a good position to give advice, like how did you meet your partner, because I think there is something worthwhile to be said from people who are in successful relationships. I think that's a good point. One other observation that I've had is, I think actually people are very eager to go out again for the most part. There are, like I said, some of the people who maybe are a little bit awkward or out of practice for the most part, you know, at least in LA, I'm seeing restaurant reservations are at an all-time high. It's actually harder to get a reservation than I think it ever was before, because there's almost like a rebound effect, right? Where everyone's like, oh my God, I want to go back out. And so I think there's also, you can try two different things. One, I think social circles are opening up again. One thing that I think was very unfortunate during COVID is social circles were very closed. Nobody wanted to, like, when they were throwing parties, they only invited sort of trusted friends and family because they didn't want to risk, obviously, infection of outside people if they weren't in your kind of like your family or your pod or people you see regularly. So strangers were, I think, less invited. Obviously, I think that's changing now. So I think social circle game is still fantastic and way of meeting people, because obviously if someone knows you or can vouch for you, or even if you have one person in common, right, you're not a complete stranger. And I think that still goes a long way in terms of meeting people, because at least if you're a friend of a friend or even a friend of a friend of a friend, someone knows you, there's some connection to the community. So I think there's a lot more like trust and relatability when you do that. And now is the great time. You should go back out and ping your friends, even if they're acquaintances, and say, hey, no, we haven't talked in a long time. Obviously, you know, you have an excuse, right? COVID kind of shut things down for a while. Getting back out there, trying to do some fun things this summer. Let me know if there's anything interesting going on, right? Invite me to your events, or when you're going out with your friends, invite me along. So I think people are very open about that. Like when you're just open and honest with people and say, hey, look, I'm trying to meet new people, right? Invite me next time you're hanging out in a group or you're hanging out with your friends. Hopefully if they're nice, you know, they'll invite you along. So I think that's a great way of doing it. Second, I think there's a class of events that are more inclined for people who are kind of more open, I would say, more open to experience or more open to meeting people. So in a lot of cities, particularly big cities, there are kind of like LA events, for instance. There's kind of websites or apps that host like interesting events. I'll give you an example. Actually, here in LA, there's a weekly like movie series where they host these outdoor screening of movies in like beautiful parks. So they had it actually in Will Rogers State Park, and they put on this huge movie screen with amazing outdoor speaker system, and they put on Dirty Dancing. Everyone brought out picnic blankets. There must have been like 200 people there. And it was actually a very amazing experience. It was very fun, but also, you know, it was like a lot of people out and about. So if you came early, they opened this park up at 5:30. Movie didn't start till 8:30, right? And 8:30 to 10:30, the movie played for 2 hours. Like that would be a great opportunity, right? Because these are people who obviously want to go out. A lot of people are hanging out early, and they're 3 hours before the movie's there. So you can just go around, socialize, talk to people, right? So that's an example of sort of an event where people are a little bit more open, I would say, to kind of conversation. And also the venue is open. It's a public park. You're kind of walking around, versus like, I don't know if it's like a club or people are kind of sitting at a table. It's hard to go up and interact with people in sort of the same way. So I would say also like try to look for events that like, you know, is conducive to people who are new to cities, are trying to meet new people, or the venue or the occasion is a little bit more open to, you know, meeting people and talking to people and interacting. Because I think there are better places and events that are conducive to talking versus ones that are clearly not.
I would just like to add about in terms of meeting women, I found dancing clubs very helpful. Mm-hmm. Because particularly as they skew towards a female demographic, many of them are, you know, they'd love to have men there to act as dance partners for the women. Mm-hmm. And also the women there to be very sociable. I find that is a very good place to to meet dates. It's much better than these dating apps. Also, other venues where, like churches, for example, where the demographics skew female, I find that these dating apps like Tinder and stuff, they tend to be often an ego boost for a lot of the women who use them. Right. As the gentleman said before, many of the photos are heavily edited and not representative of how they look. They can put photos and it's used as much of an ego boost for right. some of its users. They like to put photos on and they get 50 replies, especially women, because the demand for women is much greater than the supply. It's they have the benefit of the supply demand imbalance. And you can message a woman and there's probably very little likelihood that anything will arise from it. From my experiences, I would really recommend venues where, you know, that are inherently social, or where there's where the demographic tends to skew female. I think you have a much better opportunity in that case, especially, for example, dancing clubs or even yoga or things for which women, you know, where the demographic, where the attendees would be mostly female.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. When you say dancing clubs, are you talking about like salsa dancing or like particular types of dancing or like nightclubs?
Exactly, like salsa dancing and, you know, different clubs with, like I went to some like Latina clubs mm-hmm. Where they taught you to do some of the, I was terrible at it. Like we did the merengue and stuff and I was a disaster. Right. And if anything, that was even better for them because they were all coming up, you know, trying to teach me in vain. Right. Trying to perfect my method and stuff. And that was a very useful way of getting contacts.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's a great anecdote as well. So but I think that's a good point. I think a lot of guys are intimidated when they're not expert at this, but that's not a negative sign. Like, well, A, it's a good excuse to like go and learn a skill over time. I actually think, you know, a lot of times there's a little bit of an, you know, waste of time / intimidation factor when you're going out and the entire point is to meet women. Because then if you've, I don't know, didn't have a good night, didn't get any phone numbers, you feel like, oh, it was a waste of an evening or I didn't do well. Versus if you're like, hey, look, I want to get good at salsa dancing. And yes, I want to meet some women too. But, you know, if you didn't end up meeting someone that night, you still had some fun. You got better at something. It's good physical activity for your health as well. And then that way it's not a loss, right? If any particular night it didn't turn out well. But yes, I think it's also very useful to be smart and realize the demographics are clearly in your favor. I think dancing is a great, I mean, it's the most, one of the most traditional ways that people, even going back like hundreds of years, you know, people meet people. The other great thing about it is it's socially approved physical touch, right? In terms of figuring out chemistry, there is no better way, I think, than actually dancing with someone and touching someone, obviously in a socially appropriate way. So you know very quickly, as opposed to a dating app, even much better than any picture or video, like, you know, what does this person look like? How do they move? Do I like their scent? Do I like the way their skin is? You know, like all that stuff. You pick that up very quickly and also very intuitively when you dance with someone. So I think it's a great thing. You know, you got to decide whether or not you want to kind of put the investment in terms of dancing. But there are other activities.
I think yoga studios are another place to meet wonderful, highly intelligent, highly aware type of women, if that's your thing.
Yeah,
or
absolutely.
Gyms. I mean, obviously don't go and be like, hey, let me like watch you squat. Like, don't be a fucking pervert or like a creep. But like in a right setting, I think like I picked up girls at the gym all the time. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And you approach it in a friendly manner where like you want to be helpful or you want to like get a workout in a, I don't know, like same equipment that they're using or whatnot. And it's busy. Like I think it always works. Obviously if they have their headphones in and they're like super like focused in their workout or whatever they're doing, you know, be conscious of that. But sure. I think overall, depending on what type of woman you like, I think that is definitely a suitable place to also meet, you know, opposite gender like women. But I agree with you in terms of the dancing. I think everything you touched upon is right on the money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think particularly if you have an inclination towards health and fitness and you like women who are into that and have the bodies that are indicative of someone who takes care of themselves, no better place to meet women. I agree. Be very mindful. My general philosophy, rule of thumb is like, obviously don't interrupt people like during class or during their workout, but if you do it in a respectful way before or after, you know, the yoga class or whatever it is, and there's, you know, natural time to sort of do that, I think it's great. And also it's one of those things that I think all over time too, I wouldn't recommend like going to one yoga class and trying to do it, but like, you know, if you kind of become a regular, you also become a little bit more trustworthy in the eyes of people versus I think people can kind of tell when you're going and you're just like clearly there to scope out women, versus like, okay, you go on a regular basis, you're doing your weekly Saturday yoga, it complements your weightlifting. And yeah, if you happen to see someone there that's interesting, they're like, oh yeah, I've seen you here on a regular basis, blah, blah, blah. Strike up a conversation, and it also becomes more naturalistic too. It's like, it's not like, oh, I have one shot, one opportunity to go, you know, get this phone number or else it's not going to work out, versus you can literally build a relationship over time, right? You're like, okay, I've seen this person 3, 4, 5 times. And then, you know, first you get to know them, maybe just once after class, you just chat, get, you know, find out who they are, find out their interests and hobbies, talk more and more, and then eventually leads to relationship. If you think about that, that's actually kind of what people used to do all the time, right? At school or work, right? You don't like see like hone in on someone walking across the campus, ask for their number, and then run away. You know, you see that person in class, you go up and talk to them, maybe you talk about homework, you do whatever, and then over time, you obviously start dating over time. And I think that's just how people are used to dating. It's how I think people prefer it, right? Because then you're not a stranger, and they have to sort of evaluate you like based on that one approach. So I do think the investment of going to something on a regular basis, being a known face there, is very helpful. By the way, the other reason that's really helpful, in addition to the familiarity effect that I'm talking about, is social proof, right? Women are highly influenced by social proof. And this is actually, by the way, this is why it's actually useful to develop a skill. I know lots of guys who are like amazing salsa dancers or they do bachata or things like that. They're not good at other things. Like I would say like in terms of their professional like development or other aspects, maybe even like physical attractiveness, they're not in the top whatever 20% like I was talking about. But they are in dancing. They're really good at it. And so when they're, you know, they're in that kind of circle or in that venue, they're seen as like the top males, alpha dogs, whatever you want to call it, right? Because of their skill level in that. And it looks very impressive. And in the context of that environment, they're like, oh, wow, this guy is really amazing. So it's a good lesson about like play to your strengths, right? Where if you can sort of demonstrate higher value because you're particularly good at something in that context and or you're seen as a leader, then that's a positive thing. Same thing too. If you know a lot of the people at like a venue and like, you know, the doorman and the instructors, they all know you and like you because you've built a relationship with them over time. You're a regular, you know, everyone's like, oh, wow, this guy knows everyone, right? And everyone treats them well. And like, because you have treated them well over time. Now, you're obviously not doing this instrumentally because, oh, I need to only be nice to people in order to meet women. No, be nice because it's the right thing to do as a human being. But on the context of doing that, people are always impressed when you like know everyone and everyone knows you. And like I said, it reduces that stranger danger effect when, whether it's a dance club or a gym or whatever, everyone knows you, they're dapping you up, they're giving you hugs. They're like, hey, what's up? How are you doing? You know, you look like the popular guy. You look like the big man on campus, to use sort of a college analogy. And that also elicits that social proof that we're sort of talking about. So that's the best thing to do. You can do that, by the way, at bars and restaurants too, right? Like, you know, tip the doorman, tip the waiters, the bartenders, etc. If you're a regular and they know you, when you bring a date there, they'll hype you up, right? Or they'll dap you up. They'll, you know, be like, okay, get free, you know, courtesy, free dessert or free drinks. And, you know, your date's going to be impressed by that because they're like, oh, okay, this is a guy who treats people well. Even kind of service workers, blue collar retail workers. That's obviously something about your morals and ethics. And is someone who's likable and has social proof around that. So that's also something that's, it's almost like a complement to social circle game, where even if you're not meeting people through your friends, you can actually meet people through professional venues and organizations that you frequent because you've built sort of professional relationships with those folks. And, you know, like I said, it increases the trustworthiness and aura around you.
One last thing I would suggest is if you have a dog, dog parks are great. I've only been dogged out for like 6-7 weeks. And oh my God, my dog is a golden doodle, so I don't have to talk. He just does all the work for me, but definitely hit up dog parks. All right. Last comment. That was it.
This is
you're,
true.
You're the man, Dr. Cam.
Thank you. But yeah, no, dogs are like a kryptonite. You know, it's really funny to me, by the way, that this is like an interesting social phenomenon. it there's a weirdness about going up to a stranger, you know, at least in American society, or being approached by a stranger. But when there's a dog involved, like literally, even though it's a stupid excuse, like you just comment on the dog and be like, hey, your dog's cute, what's your dog's name, blah blah blah, people are totally open to talking to strangers, right? Because it's almost like this like universal icebreaker that's acceptable, and Americans love their dogs. They love to talk about their dogs. And so having a dog, or even, you know, it's kind of funny too, even if someone else has a dog, obviously talking about their dog is the best icebreaker there is, and they're so used to that, in fact, that it's more normal than abnormal. So yeah, I mean, obviously, if you are going to get a dog, get it because you like a dog. But yes, it's a nice perk to be able to talk to people out and about, going for walks, dog parks, etc. And yes, you know, if you think about it, it's a clever kind of hack too, because you have a particularly cute dog, like your doodle over there. You know, it elicits positive feelings, and positive feelings get associated with you, right? So they may think your dog is cute, but you end up looking cute as a result because they got the googly feelings from your dog. By the way, that's also the same reason why it's great to actually meet people in an exercise context. They're sweating, their heart rate's up, their adrenaline's going, which if you think about it, mimics being attracted, falling in love, having you know, sex, right? It's the same sort of physiological activation response. So this is a clever social psychology experiment. I think they did a study in which they had people go on two different dates. One was a very like neutral date, sit down, stare at each other, you know, coffee kind of thing. The other date, I think they had to like cross a bridge in like a national park, and it was kind of like a shaky bridge, so it induced a lot of anxiety. And then they had the women rate their dates afterwards, and obviously the ones that did the scary bridge walk rated their date as better, and they wanted to go out with them again, even though it's like the same people, right? And the reason for that was they're mistaking their feeling of adrenaline as being physically attracted, right? So obviously, like, don't abuse that principle, but there's something to be said about doing a physical activity with your partner. So I do think either meeting people in contexts in which you're doing physical activity, or I particularly also like first dates that are physically active. Take people to play pool or billiards, take people to go bowling, do something active. Don't do crazy stuff though. I always see people like inviting people on first dates to go like rock climbing. And I was like, unless they're into rock climbing, it's too intimidating of a first date. Like no girls like wants to do something that's like kind of dangerous and you're staring at her ass, and it's the whole thing is very awkward. I've actually heard from women, they've been invited on rock climbing first dates and they're just like, no, this is like too much. Like I said, unless they're a climber and they're totally comfortable with that. But pick something that's physical but easy. Like you don't want to go climb a mountain. You like a very light hike, you know, like a nice interesting walk in a interesting place or interesting park. Pool and bowling is like very low key. You're not really even sweating. You want to do something that's easy and approachable and not intimidating if you're going to do a physical activity. You don't want to do something that's like actually physically dangerous or scares the lights out of them or it's just awkward. If they have to change their clothes for the activity, it's probably too much, I would say, for a first date. Sure, maybe for a second or third date, you're getting to know them, you want to take them surfing or something and they need a wetsuit, fine. But I would say keep it a little easier on the first date. You don't want to create barriers, right? You want to just keep it as simple and easy to say yes as possible.
So how do you handle like the fallout of awkwardness of rejection? Like if you're running day game, you go into your favorite coffee shop and you know you ask that barista out on a date and she says no, you get rejected. How do you handle the awkwardness of going back into that coffee shop again? Or like, I'm not afraid of the rejection part. I think it's the actual awkwardness of, do you ever go back and do you show your face around that coffee shop again? I don't know.
Yeah, okay, well, this is a good question because I think there's a difference between hitting on the employees of a venue that you frequently often. You have to be pretty savvy about that, right? If you're hitting like on a gym and you're planning on staying at that gym for a long time, you don't want to be hitting on all the employees because then you become that guy, right? And so unless you really like that person and like I said, you probably want to develop a relationship over time and kind of feel that person out before you go and do that because you're going to have to see their face for the next whatever few months or years. You want to be, I would say with employees, a lot more selective than you would. Versus, you know, you stop into a random Starbucks, you see a cute girl sitting there, and if you don't talk to her, you're never going to see her again for the rest of your life. take the chance and go talk to her, and whatever, you strike out, you're probably never going to see her again anyway, right? Versus like, it's literally the Starbucks that you go to that's closest to your house and you want to go there forever. So I would say, you know, use your judgment and put your bar a little bit higher if it is, like I said, an employee who's there and it's someplace that you frequent and you want to continue to frequent. So that's first things first. Second thing is, look, in the end though, if you decide I'm gonna take that chance, you just have to you know, man up and deal with the rejection. The reality of like, especially kind of cold approaches, or it's a numbers game in the end. And until you get really good at it, but even if you say, let's say good at it, if you think about the reality of how relationships form, this the biggest factor, and people underestimate this, is timing, right? Like, you may be super attractive. You may be a quality guy. The woman may, in fact, may have been interested in you, but she could be in a relationship, and so she's completely not available. Maybe she's just getting out of a relationship, and she doesn't want to be in a relationship. Maybe you caught her at a bad time of, you know, like in terms of her life, and she's not in a good mood that day. There's all these like factors that have nothing to do with you. So you have to, I think, just really not take rejection personally. That's the thing. I know it's easier said than done, but I think the way that you don't take it personally is you realize that, honestly, like the majority of the time has nothing to do with you, right? Because it's just, you didn't have the right timing to be there. Second of all, it's completely presumptuous that 100% of the time, every single woman that you would talk to is going to like you. So, I mean, you don't need to. Like, look, in the end, you're trying to find one person if you're trying to find a long-term monogamous relationship, and not everyone's going to be into you. That's okay. I think we just have to like understand the reality of like odds, right? So that's the second thing I'd say. Just like, look, in the end, you only need one person. If 99% of women reject you and you find one person and you're happy with that person, great. You've won. You've won the game as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't matter how many people reject you. So that's the second thing I would say is like, don't be a machine and go out there cold approach like 100 people necessarily in a day. But in the end, it is kind of a numbers game, and you just have to accept the reality of the fact that rejection is just, it's going to be par for the course. It is what it is. It's not an evaluation of your self-worth. And then the third thing I would say is what also really helps, I think, in terms of depersonalizing it and dealing with rejection is the way that I always think about it is they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting your approach, right? And so maybe you were awkward when you went up and talked to them because you were stumbling over your words. You just seemed really nervous and not confident. And that's not you that they're rejecting. It's because in that moment, you were kind of a bumbling idiot. And so they're rejecting the bumbling idiot version of you that you presented. That's something that can be improved. That's something that can get better. And maybe in a different context or in a different world, you come up, you're very smooth. She likes the tone of your voice. She likes your body language. You're exuding confidence, sexiness, etc. And she would have said yes if you just approached her differently, right? And so if you think about it from that frame, you're like, okay, she did reject me. Great. How can I analyze this and say, what did I do wrong? Maybe she just had a boyfriend and there's nothing you could have done about it. But maybe it's like, I was kind of awkward, let too many silences kind of hang, didn't have anything interesting to say. And so I got to practice, right? I got to change my approach. I got to do it better. And so when you do think about it that way, like I said, you're separating the person from your behavior. It's not an indictment of you. It's not an indication that you're not worthy or lovable by someone. You just got to step up your game and improve the way that you approach, come off as better, smoother, charming, etc. And that just comes with practice and being willing to be rejected. The more that you're willing to be rejected, the better that you're going to get, and the better your approach is going to be, and the better the results that you're going to get. So you have to just chalk it up to a learning curve and be like, yep, I'm going to strike out a whole bunch of times and in order for my approach to get better and for me to find better people. So that's the way that I would think about it. So great radio show, everyone. I'll catch you next week. Same time, same place. Thursdays at 6 o'clock. Thanks everyone who joined, and we'll post a couple links in the Discord if you're interested in following up on any of the material discussed today.